Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Welcome to How I Built This Lab. I'm Guy Raz. So there are lots of people who want to buy a home and who can afford to pay the mortgage. The problem is the down payment. In most cases, you need to have 20% of the purchase price in cash before a bank will lend you the money for the mortgage. Well, this is a huge problem for millions of people, especially people who can't go to mom or dad or who don't have intergenerational wealth. And in many of those cases, that means people who are not white or people who have solid middle-class jobs like nurses or teachers or emergency workers and firefighters. Many of them can't afford to buy homes in the cities where they work. So Alex Lofton, my guest today, is trying to help fix that. In 2015, Alex and two friends launched Landed. It's a company that helps people who do essential work buy homes by helping them with the down payment. In exchange for providing the cash for the down payment, Landed gets an equity stake in the home. And when it eventually sells or the owner refinances the mortgage, Landed's investors get a share of the appreciation. Today, Landed has helped over 1,000 essential workers buy a home in more than 30 states across the country. And long before starting this company, Alex watched firsthand as his parents, two public sector workers in Bellevue, Washington, struggled to pay the bills.
I would say like 80% of the reason my parents would fight would be over money. It would be about the month to month, just making the next bill. How is that going to happen? What were we not going to do? You know, and I didn't really quite understand, because I would go, if we went to a toy store, you know, I would just tell my mom, I want this toy. She said we couldn't afford it. And I would just say, well, just pull out your checkbook. Just write a check.
Yeah.
You know, that's where it comes from. And I had no idea, no concept that a check had to be related to something in a bank account. That was out of this world to me. So I think as I got older, I appreciated how relative the entire world, how lucky we were. And how actually not poor we were. But when you're around a bunch of babies of Microsoft.
Multimillionaires.
Yeah.
Did your parents own a home?
They did not own a home until I was 11 or 12. My grandmother, Granny, my mom's mom, she was not only my best friend at the time, but she was the first time in our family where someone owned something they could pass along. So when she died, she passed her home along to my parents. So it's a first example of intergenerational wealth being transferred to someone. And that was the game changer.
So you went on to Northwestern for college, and you ended up working for Obama's first campaign, which must have been a pretty amazing experience at the time.
Oh, man. It was awesome. My first job out of college is like working for this guy who— First of all, my parents thought I was crazy. I was graduating from a very expensive school, and I had to take out debt. And I was choosing to go work for this campaign where I was going to get paid $800 a month.
Yeah.
My parents were like, why are you working for this guy? No one can pronounce his name. Hillary Clinton is obviously going to win.
Yeah, because you started working for him early, like before he was the front runner in 2007.
Oh, yeah. I jumped on the campaign first as a volunteer. I showed up with my tie on, and I brought in a briefcase, and they said, you know, what's your background? What do you hope to do here? And I said, I would like a paid job, preferably in policy, and you know, I prefer a 5-day-a-week situation. And they said, well, you can take off that tie, never wear that again. Sit in the corner making phone calls for our field department, all hours of the night, if you want to do that. And you know, didn't sound too glamorous. But I said, heck, why not? And I jumped on as a volunteer, but I came for what this guy, Barack Obama, was saying and the vision for the future that I agreed, you know, really resonated with me. And I ended up staying because of the people that were showing up. You had organizers from labor movements. You had management consultants. You had top lawyers. You had technologists. You had all these people from all corners of society coming together and saying, I think I have something to contribute here to try to do a campaign differently.
So I think you did a variety of stints working for Obama for America over a few years. And presumably, I mean, I have to imagine that early experience, you know, that was that certainly the first campaign. There was a lot of energy, idealism. There was a lot of people who were committed to social justice work, when many of them eventually started social enterprises. Do you think that's where your energy for what you do now in part came from?
For sure. I would never trade in that opportunity that I had to work on the Obama campaign for anything. It really did ground me both in understanding the power of having clear set of values that you operate from as an organization and making sure that that's known and felt across the entire operation. In that case, in the Obama campaign, it was all about respect and power include. You know, no matter what, there's a way in which you can honor what people, what their talents and their resources, what they are and what they can bring to the table. And you could find a way to line those up to achieve a greater outcome if you just empower them right. I also learned personally what I'm passionate about, what I'm good at. And what I'm good at is enrolling people. My dad always said, if I had been an ounce more religious, I definitely would have been a pastor. But given that that wasn't my path, that, you know, getting people excited, telling a story, having people see themselves in that story and getting them motivated to be a part of it was what my job was.
Yeah.
But I didn't, you know, this is in hindsight. At the time, I was just doing it because I thought, man, this is the next thing that needs to happen. And I also never thought a guy that looked like me would ever have a chance of running for president.
Tell me, when you say guy who looks like me, what do you mean?
Well, I'm a half black guy who grew up with a mom who's white, a dad who's black. But, you know, to the outside world, I'm a black man in America.
Yeah.
And I genuinely thought that maybe by the time I'm dead, we'd see a president, you know, when I'm older, be a black guy, but not in 2007, 2008. And honestly, that was where all the skepticism was coming from. For example, from my own father, a black man who said,
right.
This is
never going to happen.
This is nuts. This is never going to happen.
Yeah.
And so, you know, part of my motivation to be a part of that campaign was, well, you know, I don't know if we're going to win this. I can't predict this, but I know it's worth working on and trying. There's a viable path here. It's going to be a lot of work. So it's that kind of one part delusion and one part grounded reality that I think I learned there that ultimately was successful in the campaign that kind of drove me to bring that to other ventures.
All right. You end up going to do an MBA at Stanford. And one of the beauties of going to business school is that you can often meet other super motivated people who want to start a business. And that's what you did. You met some friends there who you ended up co-founding Landed with. Before we get to Landed, what was the problem that you landed on, so to speak? What was the problem that you discovered or thought about that you wanted to try and figure out how you could solve?
I remember sitting in, I think I'm the only person in the world that was inspired in an intro to finance class. And in this class, we talked a lot about the concept of diversification and the power of diversifying where your money is so that if one investment goes up, another one can go down and you still could be in a good place. And that was key to how rich people stayed rich. And I just remember sitting there and being struck by the fact that no one in my social circles thinks that way. Like, people don't have enough stuff, enough money, enough capital to even think about diversifying. Most people are just thinking about, how the heck am I going to save enough to ever get a down payment on a home?
Right.
That's really about the pinnacle of investing, is having your own home. And I thought, man, it would be really, first of all, crazy that I'm an overeducated person and just now thinking about this. Why haven't I been forced to really learn this earlier on? And number two is, what if we could bring the tools of high finance and tools of the wealthy to more people?
Yep.
Democratize who has access to build wealth in the first place.
And just to clarify for a sec, I mean, when you're hearing this idea about wealth diversification, you start thinking, how can we democratize access to tools that enable people to build wealth? You're not thinking like, oh, let's do an easy trading platform or an easy like index fund or something. You're thinking property.
That's where my head went, because that's what I knew really well. And honestly, I'm a millennial. A millennial who lived in San Francisco Bay Area. I was like, how the heck am I going to be able to afford to buy a home at some point? You know, it was a selfish motivation too. Just like, I need a tool that moves me from being a renter to being an owner, the zero or one, you know, kind of dilemma. What's the gradient in between? I will say though, that's where, you know, partnering up, meeting other people who have come from a different background was super important. Something I also believe in. And if you're going to build something great, you got to diversify your team. And my co-founder, Jonathan, came at it from a slightly different angle, but awakened me to another thing that was going on in our economy and our society, which is, given how expensive land is and becoming, this is one area that had yet to really leverage technology to disaggregate or disintermediate investing in something like real estate. That there were a lot of people that would want to invest in real estate, but just can't because the cost of entry is too big. So what if you made it easier to access investment in one of the biggest asset classes in the world and do so in a more cooperative way with the people who want to live in it? So it wasn't just, hey, we're going to buy up property and rent it back out to people, that actually you can have occupants be a part owner in it. And then that would be a really interesting proposition to big time investors, because they're trying to figure out another way. You know, you had Blackstone and others after the 2008 financial crisis buy up a bunch of properties that used to be for ownership and now are only rental. And that wasn't a world that either John and I were super excited about.
Yeah. All right. You guys are at Stanford, and this is 2015, and you come up with this concept for Landed, which we'll really get into in a moment. But essentially, at that time, and it's even more so today, for the average person in America to buy a piece of property, a house in the Bay Area, was out of reach. I mean, I think today you need $1 million at least, and that's almost still impossible to find a home for $1 million in, you know, metro San Francisco area and San Jose area. Right. It's crazy. Which means that you can't have a normal functioning city when a huge number of people can't afford to live there, because you need a city with nurses and construction workers and, you know, and firefighters and cops and people who are earning good salaries, plumbers, electricians. I mean, cities can't function without these people. And they can't afford to buy houses in markets like Seattle or the Bay Area or New York or, you know, L.A. or et cetera.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, good salaries. A lot of these folks have pensions, right? They actually have they have some mechanism where they're starting to build wealth, but they're not paid enough to put money into retirement, pay the cost of living for where they live, and save for a down payment. And, you know, these are people who can't just pick up their laptop and go work remotely. You got to be present for them. When the story that really struck me is that there was a teacher in the South Bay of the Bay Area who would drive 2.5 hours each way to get to work. Wow. Sometimes would decide just to sleep in their car because they didn't want to drive back. There's the emotional part of me that says, oh, that just feels wrong, right? Yeah. I don't want that to exist. But honestly, the math side of me, this equation doesn't add up. If this keeps happening, no one's going to be able to or work in these positions. And if they don't work in these positions, who's there to teach your kids? And who wants to live in a place where there aren't teachers, right? And so I think about this as an infrastructure challenge. How do you make sure that you have the people that you need to build the cities and the societies that you want to build and support them, you know, uphold them? Because they're upholding all of us every single day. They're doing all this stuff that we all depend on every single day. Why aren't we actually upholding them? And there seems to be a way in which we just think more creatively about the financial tools that are actually available, but making them more widely available to people, leveraging technology to do so. There is a huge opportunity here.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, more from Alex about the struggles Americans face in becoming homeowners and how his company, Landed, is working to change that. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This Lab. One more thing before we get back to the show, please make sure to click the follow button on your podcast app so you never miss a new episode of the show. It's usually just at the top of the app, and it's totally free. Welcome back to How I Built This Lab. I'm Guy Raz. My guest today is Alex Lofton, co-founder and president of Landed. So the problem is that there are all of these so-called essential employees, people who have essential jobs, who have a stable, steady income. Some of them earn a pension, but in many cases, they don't have the cash to put down on a home. So you come up with a concept to figure out a way to help finance that, to give them some of the money for a down payment. Let's talk first about how you decided which jobs would be eligible for help from Landed.
That decision on who our customer was at the end of the day came after we figured out this tool, to be honest. Yep. You know, we because for all the reasons that you just listed, it was who most acutely is going to feel this problem of not having the upfront wealth needed to buy a home, and who don't have the only other option that's available out there, which is the bank of mom and dad.
Yeah.
You know, going and borrowing money for, or getting money from a family member to get started. If you don't have that, who is having this problem? Well, it's the person who could otherwise afford a mortgage, right?
Because
our product helps people who have enough money to afford rent on a monthly basis, but can't do that and afford the down payment.
I mean, if you can afford to pay $800 to $1,500 a month in rent, in most of America, you can afford to pay a mortgage.
Mm-hmm. Right. But if you don't have the, whatever, $100,000 to $200,000 up front to get the mortgage in the first place, you're, you know, SOL. So the core concept here was, okay, who has kind of the jobs that are paying relative enough to afford a mortgage but may not have the upfront cost? What are the jobs that are relatively countercyclical, right? So if the economy goes down, these jobs still exist. Well, they tend to be these infrastructure jobs in education and healthcare and government. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the lesson here for us was make sure the product that you have is actually solving a real problem for people. Mm-hmm. And these are the people who are feeling this problem the most. And you could partner with their employer, somebody who they trust to communicate, to market that this product exists. And that's ended up what we did. We ended up partnering with school districts and hospitals and governments to kind of get the word out about our product so that their staff wouldn't just feel like, hey, what's this sketchy thing I found on the internet that's offering down payment program, but actually this is something that's trying to address a challenge that they know I have.
So nurses, teachers, first responders, the idea is to help them get the cash to buy. Now, before we go on how this works and how you turn it into a business, you came from, you know, a lot of your experience had been in the nonprofit world, right? And so I wonder, did the three of you talk about making this a nonprofit at the outset?
Yeah, one of the earliest conversations was, what's the corporate structure going to look like? What's going to be the best? And our approach, our thinking was, okay, we know there's a challenge here for a lot of people with this down payment piece. And we know that to create a different world, we're going to have to eventually move just more money than God to make this happen.
Yeah.
Because, you know, each person, if you're talking about offering up to $150,000 per buyer, that's a lot of money when you start multiplying how many people that would use support like this. So we're going to have to mobilize a lot of money. It's going to take a lot of infrastructure to get us there. And frankly, there's an unknown timeline here, how long it's going to take to make that happen. With an unknown amount of money that's going to take, with a lot of risk. And it was clear to us at the time that venture seemed to be the right fit.
Yeah.
And you know, there's other pieces that are worth mentioning. We were going to have to compete for talent. Mm-hmm. And we're going to need a lot of engineers.
Yeah.
And engineers, if their option is to go get equity from one company over us, we're going to have to compete with that.
You needed engineers to build an interface for potential users
in an interface for the consumer, but also just, it's a lot of data management of like what properties are being purchased, what their value is, and what that means for the investors that we are partnering with. So there was just a lot of components there. And so to be able to compete, we wanted to be able to offer real ownership in something.
All right. So you had to raise money, and then you'd have a pool of money that you could then use to give to people to help them buy their home.
Well, we would be helping people access a traditional mortgage. That was our goal.
Okay.
You know, once you get to a traditional mortgage, which basically means you need to have 20% down.
Right, yeah.
That was the golden number we're trying to get people to.
Yep.
So our job was to get people to that 20%. They would then have to go to a bank or a mortgage lender to get the other 80%.
But you were focused on the down payment, the 20%. And that was what the pool of money you needed to raise would go towards.
Well, that was one of the pools of money we have to raise. We were, one thing that I never thought I would become was a fundraising machine. But that, you know, we had to raise money. That was the what's called a propco, the property company. We had to raise money that was available to the individual buyer to invest in their home to help them with the down payment. That was kind of one stream. The other stream was we needed money to run our company.
Yep.
And that was the operating business, the OpCo. And that's where we raised money from venture.
Yep.
So it has always been a dual fundraising challenge. And on top of that, of course, that's the fundraising piece. Then we had to actually do the work of building the infrastructure,
yep.
right? You know, we were building off of shoulders of others. There have been institutions since the 70s that have been leveraging shared appreciation or shared equity to help people into homes. The reality is, though, it's always been specific organizations, maybe one city at a time that was doing this. No one had really figured out how to make this a scalable solution.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let me see if I understand more or less how the model works. Basically, a homeowner needs money, needs 20% for the down payment. They may only have 10%. Mm-hmm. So they go to you and you give them the rest. So let's say they need $100,000, they only have 50, you give them $50,000. It is not a loan. It essentially is an investment in the future value of their house. And so you get nothing. And then if they refinance their home or sell their home one day and it appreciates, you guys get a cut of how much it appreciates.
Of how much it appreciates. Yeah.
Right.
How much of the part of the change in value. And the person would share back that portion of the change in value that they agreed to when they bought their home,
mm-hmm.
Plus what they originally got. Our initial model was for every kind of 1% down payment support you get, you would share in 2.5% of appreciation. So if you get 10% down payment support, you're going to share in 25%.
And all right, so now lots of questions, because it's an amazing model, right? I mean, it enables people who don't have the cash up front to get, I mean, essentially free money. And, you know, you're getting an equity stake in the future appreciation of the home. But let's start with what happens if the home doesn't appreciate and the person sells it in 10 years and they actually sell it for less than what they bought it for, or, you know, or it only appreciates a tiny bit.
Yep. Well, in that case, what you said about it being feeling like free money, you know, would be the case. We're always very clear with people, this isn't free money.
It's a risk. You're taking a risk.
Well, it's also, I mean, there is a real cost to it. If there's a potential that you're going to share in some of the equity, you know, essentially that you're gaining from this investment, that's a cost. It's just that it's not fixed. It's not fixed. We can't,
yeah.
We're not going to say it's definitely this percentage of the borrowed money, which is what a loan is.
Yeah.
That's what you will do with your mortgage. And the other piece is there's no monthly cost to it.
Yeah.
So in that way, on a month-to-month basis, this is the whole thing. You know, like for most families, we're talking about, like back to my own experience with my family, it's about cash flow. It's about a month-to-month management of your money. And so if you can get money that you don't have to add to your debt burden, that can be a huge thing, and that's what this would do.
In other words, if I needed $50,000 from you to buy a house mm-hmm. for the down payment, it's very possible that, you know, I wouldn't communicate with you for another 20 years.
I mean, we do our best to communicate with you to let you know, let you know that we still exist and that, hey,
right.
if you wanted to refinance today, this is what you would share. You may not want to hold on to this forever. We really actively try to manage people out of the partnership because we think of it as a stair step into ownership.
Because you want them to own 100% of it.
We want them to own the 100% of the home. That's in their interest. And then we want to recycle the capital.
Yeah.
You know, our investors are doing this because they want to see that money recycled, whether that's an impact from an impact perspective, they want to reinvest it in the next teacher, or they want to gain a return from it. Either way, they want to see that kind of recycled back before 30 years.
So the goal, of course, is to build homeownership because that is the most common way to wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And so from what I've read about Landed, many of the people who are working with you are coming from lower income backgrounds, also minority communities as well, right? I mean, a lot of mm-hmm. Black, mm-hmm. Latino, first-time homeowners who don't have that home that was passed them by their parent or grandparent.
Yeah, you're right on the nose there. I mean, it's the federal government for generations made it illegal to basically build wealth and pass it along to your next generation or set it up so that you got a chance for ownership, but then lost it. That
yeah.
happened in 2008. You know, it most impacted Black families.
Yeah.
And so the idea that, you know, if you have a tool that actually can act as the bank of mom and dad that a lot of people don't have, you could help people get into this game of home ownership, this game of ownership period that helps build wealth. And that's so what we found is that while even though you don't have to explicitly say or focus it on being a tool for BIPOC homebuyers, let's say, that you do have people disproportionately who don't come from intergenerational wealth using a tool like this.
All right. So now you take the concept to investors. You've raised, I think, close to $38 million in total.
That's on the corporate side. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot more than that on the investment side.
Okay.
But yeah.
And how much did you raise on the investment side?
We're at about $200 million.
And so I wonder how investors respond. Clearly, they believe in this because you raised a lot of money. But didn't anybody say, well, you know, Alex, we're going to give somebody cash for a down payment. And it's possible we may not see a return for 20 years or 30 years if they take a 30-year mortgage. I mean, how do we keep the cash coming in? Because we've got this pool of, let's say we have $200 million in this pool, you know, it's gonna dwindle over time if we don't have money coming in quickly enough. So how do you get it coming back faster?
Great question. Well, that's why having a strong relationship with the consumer and keeping them top of mind on how their home is not only a roof over their head and a place where the kids grow up, but actually an investment, and keeping them informed with what might be in their interest, what kind of actions might be in their interest to take to make sure they're getting the most out of that investment, including getting out of this partnership. And in talking to investors, part of the reason people got comfortable with the time horizon is that, you know, the pattern of how people refinance even without Landed is something, data that you can look at. Typically people are refinancing anywhere from 5 to 8 years to drive down their interest rate or for some other reason.
Yeah.
So if that's already happening, then you can expect that to happen with this product as well. And there are, like I said, there are a lot of different experiments with shared appreciation all over this country and actually all over the world. I mean, the UK mm-hmm. has had one of the biggest shared appreciation down payment programs ever done. And you know, the data shows that people tend to get out much sooner than 30 years. 30 years right. matches the mortgage. It makes the government comfortable. We partner with Fannie Mae to make sure we follow, you know, their guidelines. And so that is a big reason why those numbers like 30 years are there. But the reality is that it's in everybody's interest for people to get out of it sooner. And we just have the job of informing people and reminding them of that.
So what happens now when you have the situation we're in, which is high interest rates, and presumably mm-hmm. the money you've given so far to people, much of it happened before this interest rate regime now. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no incentive to refinance if you got a 3-4% interest rate, you know, mm-hmm. last year, mm-hmm. the year before.
Yep. One of the conversations you always had with investors, as well as home buyers, is recognizing that real estate's always cyclical, right? And that there's going to be changes to what, you know, whether it be just the perceived value of land or things like interest rates, these levers are going to move over time. And there's going to be certain moments when it's going to be more interesting and advantageous to say refinance or make a move, and others where it might make sense to hold on. And we're in one of those adjustment times. I think what's happened is, number one, it's the change in interest rate has made unaffordability even more of a challenge.
Yeah.
Right. So in some ways, a product like this is even in higher demand than it ever has been. That said, we've had we still have through this entire change over the last year, still have quite a few people exiting the program, just recognizing that when they do the math in the long run, instead of sharing kind of the future gains of the home that they expect, that it makes sense to kind of make a move now and fold that into their mortgage. So it hasn't prevented everybody. It definitely has changed some people's calculations.
Yeah.
Investors think about this as a portfolio investment. It's not just one investment in one home. This is actually spread out across a lot of geographies and over a lot of time.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, Alex shares more about the barriers to homeownership and how his company, Landed, is working to remove them. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This Lab. Welcome back to How I Built This Lab. I'm Guy Raz, and my guest today is Alex Lofton, whose company is expanding American homeownership by assisting educators, healthcare professionals, and government workers with those pricey down payments. So essentially, right, you are, I mean, again, to restate the obvious, you're investing in the home and the future appreciation of that home, right, the equity share. And, but do you have other revenue streams that you've developed? I mean, already, for example, if one of your customers buys a home, do you work with that customer to get the commission on the home purchase?
Great question. So that's where, kind of going back to where we're talking about kind of this idea of OpCo and PropCo. That's where these two things are really important to think about, because the investment in the down payment program that eventually goes to homebuyers, that doesn't come back to Landed Inc. That's not what pays my salary or is what our venture capitalists are seeing their return from. We are just facilitating that relationship and that transaction. You can almost think about our down payment program as our differentiating marketing tool, that people are coming to us because they want that help and they want that tool. But ultimately, we set Landed up initially as a real estate brokerage.
I see.
So just like how Redfin and others got started, we would partner with real estate agents who, if we bring them a lead, a home buying teacher who wants to use our program, they agree to share in part of their commission with us.
In other words, if you guys bring in a potential home buyer who buys the home and mm-hmm. uses Landed to help with the down payment, you guys get a cut of the commission.
The commission. And then we expanded that to mortgages as well, started our own joint venture mortgage business. We were able to be a mortgage broker in that case. And the idea here is that the growth in the business side can come as you add on more products.
Hmm. So you basically have these three revenue streams. It's the commission on the home sale, potentially. It's the commission on the being a mortgage broker, and then a share of the equity when the home sells or gets refinanced.
Well, the third component, that share of the equity of the home when it gets refinanced, we had baked that into our own revenue models. That would go back to the investors that we partnered with.
Right.
You know, we always recognize that there's an option to kind of, like any traditional fund investor, have that be a revenue stream. We felt like it was a better idea to try to be a neutral third party rather than being the investor, mm-hmm. just kind of facilitating that so we could play, you know, traffic cop, if you will.
So you're essentially running a fund, like an investment fund for people to invest in these homes, but you're not taking a fee or any money from it.
It's really, you know, you can think of it as these investors already know they are going to invest in real estate and want to invest in real estate, and they have the money available, but they just don't have a mechanism to get it out there efficiently. And so they want to work with us to be that mechanism.
So does that mean that you also have real estate agents who work for you and mortgage brokers?
We have partners. We have partner real estate agents.
That work for like other companies?
Yeah, Coldwell Banker mm-hmm. or, you know, NRT, any of these big names. And that we, you know, we just say, hey, you're going to spend a lot of money on marketing. Think about this as your marketing budget. We're going to bring you leads rather than you have to go find that person. We're going to literally bring you someone who's more ready to buy than most of your leads in the first place, because, you know, they've come to us, learned about the financing, have now access to a down payment program that helps, you know, get them ready to buy today instead of having to wait a few years to save for a down payment.
So it's sort of like, it's like the Expedia model in a sense, right? Like Expedia sends you to a hotel, mm-hmm. they're generating the lead.
That's right. We're a lead generator.
Yeah.
You got it. And, you know, and what's been really interesting with the change in this last year with interest rates and shift in the economy overall, so we also recognize that that has been our revenue model until now, and with a kind of a lot of the change in the market, we recognize there is a need to diversify how we, you know, operate the business to still provide a similar type of offering, but look at different revenue models, and we've started to shift more as a B2B, where we are working with organizations, you know, hospital systems, universities, even some companies that have capital invest themselves and want to offer homeownership as a benefit or housing as a benefit, but don't want to hire a bunch of people to do the work that we do. They don't want to rebuild the systems that we've built to try to make that be done efficiently. So now we're white labeling the kind of that same down payment structure for other institutions.
So you sort of do all of the background work, mm-hmm. but
less fundraising.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because one of the things that we learned over, you know, we started this company really integrating the two jobs of building the infrastructure and technology platform, which was the, you know, ultimately we were generating revenue through our partnerships with real estates there. That was the business model, with a need to fundraise a lot of capital for real estate investment and shared appreciation.
Yeah.
That was all under one roof. And now with kind of the way that was 2015, it's now 2023, different world. And what makes a lot more sense is kind of decouple those two things, where there's a lot of work to be done to fundraise, whether it be from private money or public money for shared appreciation. And then you need the technology and the infrastructure to actually deploy that. And that's what Landed Inc. is going to continue to do, is be that infrastructure layer. And now the fundraising opportunities are much bigger than they used to be. State of California just announced California Dream for All, the biggest shared appreciation program ever. And that was something that we helped them design. And they saw our work and said, hey, what if the state tried to scale something like this? And so, you know, there is a lot of work to be done on the fundraising side, but that is kind of now increasingly separate from the work of being the infrastructure to deploy it.
So ideally, right, you partner with a hospital or, you know, a healthcare provider or some other business that has employees, they find out about you. And ideally, that person needs help with the down payment, so you can help provide that. And then you would also help them find a mortgage lender and work with an agent to buy a house.
Yep. Get your home buying team together, as we like to say. That's it.
And so that customer doesn't pay you anything. All the money comes from these other providers?
The other institutions, yeah. In this case, the hospital system you work for would pay Landed as a vendor to kind of run this program for them. And then the money that's actually invested in that home is going to be coming from that institution. And you wouldn't need to kind of pay anybody anything until you're deciding to end the contract.
What is the average amount of money you're giving in down payment assistance?
Well, it totally depends on where, right?
Yeah.
Because in the Bay Area, you're well over $100,000 and you're like $110,000 or so. But it's averaged out. And the next biggest market for us was Denver, Colorado, a very different market, though increasingly catching up. So I think on average now, we're somewhere between $70,000 and $80,000 per home buyer.
What sort of age ranges are you seeing in people approaching you?
You got everybody. I mean, obviously, first-time home buyers, this is very attractive too, because they don't have another asset to sell and, you know, have some down payment for. So that means a lot of people who are in their maybe late 20s, early 30s, a lot of people, right, you know, making big life decisions, getting married, maybe going to have kids. But you also have people who are retired or near retirement age and haven't ever owned a home and want to own their home now. Or, you know, there's one home buyer I remember who shared that she needed help from Landed because she needed to buy a bigger home because her kids were moving back in. You know, that's the world we live in now.
Yeah.
And, you know, now she was going to have her kids and her grandkids under one roof. And so she was going to need a little bit of support to get there. So you really have people coming at this from all sorts of angles.
How much do you think some of this will shift? I mean, over the next 20 years, 30 years, you're going to see a massive transfer of wealth from boomers to their children.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is true, that there's going to be increasingly, as boomers pass away, there's going to be another shift in intergenerational wealth, which is going to trend, demographically, it's just going to trend to the boomers that have money, right?
Yeah, so it's going to be the same people who have the money are going to be passing it along to the same types of people.
And that's how capitalism has worked since day one,
right?
And so if you're trying to figure out tools to mitigate some of the, you know, the effects of capitalism that are destabilizing. Again, if you have a society where there's a ton of have-nots and not a whole lot of haves, we've seen that story play out before, and it's not great. And if you want to try to like chip away at balancing that back out, so that you know, we can have societies that survive, then you need to think about this sort of thing. How are you going to give access to people to families who haven't been able to jump into that game yet?
Yeah.
And that's kind of where you can think Landed fits in, is just helping people access that.
Do you think we can make that happen? I mean, I think most people are concerned about the unaffordability of housing in many metro areas, especially people who have lived there for a long time, because they want good public schools. They want teachers to be able to live in the communities where they teach. They want nurses to live in the communities where they provide care. I mean, in the Bay Area, many of those folks live in Stockton or Tracy and are driving 2 hours into the city every day.
You got it, yeah.
And that is incredibly destabilizing. But at the same time, our system is designed in such a way where everybody wants their home to get, you know, to appreciate, and then they can build their wealth and then one day sell it for more money. Mm-hmm. So it's, on the one hand, everybody complains about this, but on the other hand, nobody wants to say, well, you know what, maybe my house shouldn't appreciate in value so much.
Yeah, let me get off this merry-go-round and
right. We are all both complainers and complicit. So how do we fix that? How do we solve that?
That comes back to the heart of what really inspired me and Jonathan with Landed in the first place. I think it's funny that the analogy I like to think about is Elon Musk and Tesla. Now, I'm always hesitant to bring up Elon Musk because I'm not an Elon Musk follower, but I do think one thing he has been really good at is painting a really long term picture of the future.
Yes.
And asking what are the real world impediments to getting to that future.
Yeah.
And then trying to prove out how to overcome those barriers. And that with each one of those steps, something moves from being, well, it's only done this way, it can never be done another way, that's just what we're stuck in, to maybe this is okay for some people, appropriate for some people, to this is the way it is. And, you know, that's electric cars and Tesla. I mean, people said, like, it's never, no one is ever really going to want to go away from gasoline-powered cars, to this is only for wealthy people, to, you know, you have every car company now switching their entire fleet to electric. So I think part of this is you got to start somewhere and say, yeah, this is the world that we live in. Do we like the fact that residential real estate is a speculative market? Not really, but we should have changed that many decades ago in the 30s when it was kind of enshrined in how mortgages were done. And then ultimately it became a speculative investment that people could build wealth on, which has been powerful for many families. But it's also led us to where we are today. So if that's the case, then what's a different way to think about ownership besides kind of a zero or one option, an all or nothing game where you got to have this giant amount of capital up front to actually get a home? What are some options in between to try to democratize and diversify the number of people who have access to that same tool? And so that's where we came at this problem from, with the shared appreciation. I think this is one of those tools that could help chip away that in the future somebody would think, actually, the way to buy a home is to have a co-investor in it until I can be a full owner, versus needing to be an owner right off the bat. And with that kind of thinking, you can move from saying, oh, there's just no way that this is an intractable problem, that there's nothing to do, to like, hey, let's go test it out. Let's see if this works in a few markets with a few people. And if it does, let's expand it. And that's what we've been working on.
Alex Lofton, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Guy.
That's Alex Lofton, co-founder and president of Landed. Hey, thanks so much for listening to How I Built This Lab. Please make sure to click the follow button on your podcast app so you never miss a new episode of the show. And it's totally free. This episode was produced by Sam Paulson with editing by John Isabella. Our music was composed by Ramtin Arablouei. Our audio engineer was Catherine Silva. Our production team at How I Built This includes Alex Chung, Casey Herman, Chris Messini, JC Howard, Liz Metzger, Carrie Thompson, Carla Estevez, and Elaine Coates. Neva Grant is our supervising editor. Beth Donovan is our executive producer. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This. If you like How I Built This, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.